You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We've heard a lot lately about the role Twitter and Facebook played in helping Tunisian and Egyptian dissidents topple their repressive governments, but can digital technology have much of an impact in a country like North Korea, where only a tiny portion of its 25 million residents have access to the Internet? More than you might imagine, writes Robert S. Boynton in an article published in the April issue of The Atlantic. Mr. Boynton details how a handful of media organizations based in South Korea and China have succeeded in recruiting citizen journalists to get information into and out of the country that has long maintained the world's most closed society. I'm very pleased that that article, North Korea's Digital Underground, has brought Robert Boynton to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And as you point out in the article, North Korea ranked dead last, 196th out of 196 countries in Freedom House's Freedom of the Press Index. Don't journalists who want to get information into or out of North Korea have some pretty big challenges then?
It's notoriously difficult to get in or out of North Korea. And when journalists do get access to North Korea, their actions and their reporting is so limited as to be practically useless.
And in some cases, if they could be punished, a woman factory worker in North Korea was publicly executed by firing squad because she phoned news about the price of rice to someone in South Korea. That she wasn't even being a reporter.
Well, yeah, and any attempt to communicate with the South, especially, is treated as an act of treason. And these people are considered spies by the North Korean regime and treated suitably.
So they also have limited access to information. All television sets and radios in North Korean homes are set to only one channel?
Well, they're set to, I think they have a choice of two, actually. But they're fixed in such a way that you can only use those channels. All radios as well, you can own something, but it has to be certified, which means has to be fixed and restricted to exactly what the regime wants you to hear.
And is it true that North Koreans can turn down the volume on the radios, but they can't turn them off?
In every North Korean home and office, there is a single, to call it a radio is almost an exaggeration. It's a speaker, which is hardwired to a central station. And there is programming running continuously, and you can turn it down, but you cannot turn it off.
That must put a strain on the power grid.
Yes, I would think. I think they probably that's the only way to turn it off.
What about the TV sets? they probably could turn those off.
Yes, those I think they can turn on and off.
Oh, so what about computers? Can North Koreans own a computer?
Owning a computer is completely legal in North Korea. You have to register it. However, what you can then do with that computer is very limited. There's no access to the Internet.
You've called the way that information is being taken out of North Korea Samizdat-like. How close is it to the methods that were used by Russians or other people in the Soviet Union during those days?
It's similar in some of the methods in that things are duplicated and taken out. The key difference is that the technology, it's not so much Xerox machines as it was in Eastern Europe, as much as it is, you know, thumb drives and compressed CDs and SD chips and things like that.
So since radio is the primary technology the North Korean government uses to communicate with its citizens, it's kind of logical that radio would be the technology of choice for exile media outlets that are trying to get information into the country. But how do they do that if the radios are fixed to only two stations?
Well, you are allowed to have freestanding radios are illegal in North Korea. However, there are radios which are attached to cassette players, and those are legal. And there are people who do not get the radios fixed, as it were. So they have more of a range in terms of the kind of stations they can listen to. This, too, is a very dangerous thing to do, and anyone found listening to foreign broadcasts will be punished. But that's how they pick up these broadcasts from outside.
Shortwave radio.
Sometimes shortwave radio, but a lot of the radio broadcasts that go into North Korea are just on regular AM band radio as well.
So what kind of punishment would someone face who's caught with an illegal radio or listening to an illegal program?
It can be anything from being sent to a sort of a low-level labor camp, which is a sort of re-education camp, to something like the Gulag or even execution.
Well, since so many of the people in North Korea are true believers, I've seen documentary films about people, for example, young women who did performances for the great leader and a few honored Western guests, and they were concerned that they might not live up to expectation. I mean, it was almost frightening in the kind of brainwashing that was apparent there. Why would anyone want to take the kinds of chances we're talking about?
Well, you know, there are many different reasons, obviously. But, you know, among the defectors I've interviewed in Seoul, South Korea, what the usual story is that some citizen of North Korea is in fairly good standing and then has some sort of a fall, is found of guilty of some infraction, finds his or her job eliminated, and that then becomes much more of a, if not a dissident, then discontent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's a self-selecting group of people who decide to try to go outside of the normal channels of information.
And there are always people who just are curious about whether they're being told the truth or what's going on elsewhere.
Right, exactly. And as there's been more and more access to these devices, the barrier to being curious has come down.
One of the best known media outlets you've written about is called Open Radio North Korea. Where is it based and what's its target audience?
Open Radio North Korea is based in Seoul, as almost all of these organizations are. And the various news organizations or various radio stations have a kind of narrowcast strategy in which they target different parts of the audience. Open Radio North Korea is a little bit broader in that sense. It doesn't see itself as aiming at intellectuals or economic reformers specifically. And it also has a fairly broad range of broadcasting. It has everything from hard news broadcasts to serial dramas in which books are read or enacted by the various people at the station.
And those serial dramas are also a way of telling stories about what's really going on in the government?
Exactly. I mean, there's some—
The story of the Kim family?
Yes, the Kim family. I mean, like any culture, they're obsessed with the people who run it, whether it's the royal family or elsewhere. And the royal family there is the Kim family, Kim Il-sung, the founder, and Kim Jong-il, his son. And
now Kim Jong-un.
And now, reputedly, Kim Jong-un will be the successor. And they are fascinated by any kind of non-official information about them because the information they have about the royal family, their ruling family, is so sanitized and so propagandized that they want to know more.
My guest is Robert Boynton, whose article in the current issue of The Atlantic is called North Korea's Digital Underground. Open Radio North Korea broke a story that last December that a train carrying gifts from China for Kim Jong-un, the heir apparent, had been sabotaged and derailed. I mean, beyond the fact that they were able to get that information, isn't it extremely rare for acts of resistance in North Korea to be done and definitely to be reported?
Yes, it is very rare, and I think that the fact of it is extraordinary. There are, you know, there are isolated acts of resistance that take place in any society, but as you know, if they're not reported, they might as well not exist. So these sorts of things, the importance of these radio stations, I think, is that some of these sort of stray acts of rebellion that get a cumulative effect, and people see that there is, you know, that people in North Korea aren't necessarily automatons and are thinking for themselves.
And somebody who is dissatisfied might hear that somebody else was dissatisfied and realize he's not alone.
Exactly. And that's the very thing that I think the regime is most afraid of.
What about those serials and the other things that look at the ruling family? What kind of information about them is being communicated through the broadcast that contradicts what the North Korean people know about their rulers?
Well, for one thing, Kim Jong-il was reputed through an official story to have been born on Mount Paektu, which has got a great symbolism as being this spiritual place in North Korea. In fact, he was born during the Korean War in Russia. He also, the fact that he's had many different children out of wedlock and many different mistresses in addition to his wives is not widely known. And North Korean society is fairly conservative in its morality, and this is quite shocking to a lot of people. So those are just two small facts, and there are many others.
And that doesn't dissuade most people, does it? Once you believe that these people are kind of like gifts of God,
well,
it takes an awful lot to shake you.
It might, but I think that the fact is that you know, if you don't have any dissenting information, if you're only getting one story, that story is both completely convincing and also not entirely trustworthy. And the moment you start hearing other things that make sense, that are plausible, I mean, you do the math about his age. Was it really likely that Kim Jong-il was born on Mount Paektu in North Korea during their war? That's not likely. So, you know, people do think through these things.
I would think that more information about how many people are starving and how bad the economy is and how much money is spent on building up the military while people are having to sacrifice to pay for that, I would think that would be more effective.
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, it's people are aware that people are starving. People are aware that there's tremendous poverty there. What they're not aware of necessarily is how that relates to what's outside that world. For many years, they were told that they were the rich country and South Korea was terribly poor. And this, you know, this image collapsed through the most innocent of means. If they were watching bootlegged South Korean soap operas, and they would simply see how many buildings were in Seoul, how many cars were there, what people dressed like, and that, you know, told them that a lot of what they've been told was a lie.
Doesn't a group called North Korea Reform Radio direct its free market message at government bureaucrats? Are they hoping to make them rethink the economic model?
I think that's precisely what they're hoping. I mean, because you look around, you can't look around as a citizen of North Korea and know that the economic and think that the economic model is working. What the alternative is an open question, and they're trying to answer that question and very much sort of basing it on the kind of reformist economies of China.
Mm-hmm. But China has not put any pressure on North Korea to change its economic model and make it look like the Chinese approach.
Yeah, there's a great myth that the Chinese have tremendous power over the North Koreans in terms of what they will or won't do. I'm sure in many ways they've suggested the various shifts to a more market-like economy, but I don't think they can tell them anything.
We in this country, we've talked about narrowcasting as a possibility. It actually hasn't happened all that much, but it does seem to happen in the case of North Korea. There's another radio outlet called North Korea Intellectual Solidarity.
Right. The idea there is that, you know, as the founder of it told me, he said, look, you've got to realize that the bottom people are brainwashed, the top people are corrupt. The only people are these sort of intellectual core in the middle who are open to argument.
And isn't there even a small station called Shiokaze, which means sea breeze in Japanese, that was created to transmit messages to Japanese citizens who've been kidnapped by the North Koreans over the past 40 years?
Yeah, Shiokaze is one of perhaps the oddest media organizations I've ever encountered. It's a really noble effort, but it was started in order to communicate with Japanese who were abducted by North Korea in the late 70s and early 80s.
How many were actually abducted? I would have imagined that it would be in the hundreds, not enough to really have to broadcast to a group of that size.
It's really unclear. The official Japanese government's estimation is that there are 17 officially recognized abductees. This organization that runs the Shiokaze broadcast recognize abductees outside of the government estimate, and they go up to 400 or 500.
I'd imagine there also are people in North Korea who still speak Japanese because the Koreans were a colony of Japan until the end of World War II.
Correct. I mean, there's a lot of that is the not favored, but sort of that's the default second language for many people. Although, you know, for younger people, it's not. It's really only people probably in their 50s and 60s who still speak Japanese.
My guest is Robert S. Boynton of NYU, and he's the author of a number of books, including The New Journalism. His article in the current issue of The Atlantic is called North Korea's Digital Underground. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We We're back with Robert S. Boynton, who runs the Literary Reportage Concentration at NYU. And he's written an article about North Korea called North Korea's Digital Underground that is in the current issue, the April issue of The Atlantic magazine. Have you ever been to North Korea?
You know, I haven't. I've tried many times to go, and my access has been blocked.
Well, some Americans do get in, and it's in some cases rather eccentric ones. I've seen a film by an American who just persisted. I think he had an internet television show. Was not the sort of person you would have thought that they would have allowed in.
Yeah, it's very hit or miss, I think. I mean, strangely enough, now actually American citizens can go. There are all sorts of tours, or at least two tour companies that will take you there. So if you want to spend 2 weeks of your vacation in Pyongyang and its environs, you can do that.
But would they be suspicious of you?
I think they would. I think my name is on a list now.
We've been talking about radio. What about other forms of digital technology, thumb drives, because they do have computers, or cell phones?
Right, cell phones are really probably the most transformative technology in this endeavor. I mean, China has set up cell towers all up and down the North Korean border for use on either side. And cell phones have become so inexpensive that that's really probably the most ubiquitous form of communication there.
Are the Chinese willing to subvert the North Korean government in that way, their ally?
That certainly isn't their intention, but these cell phones are really because there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people living in that particular portion of China on the Yalu and the Tumen Rivers.
Well, we know what a typical conversation is. Where are you now? I'm sorry, it's breaking up.
I don't think that the service there is any better than that. Yes, it's true. But the cell phones, though, were originally used by traders, people going back and forth across the North Korean-Chinese border for food and for other sorts of goods. And they've gradually become used more and more for news and other organizations. And there's some of them are these very sophisticated South Korean cell phones, which are capable of transmitting video and audio data and all sorts of things within a few miles of the border.
I'd assume that there you get punished for doing this as well.
Oh, yeah, if you're found with an unofficial phone. There is an extensive official phone, Orascom, which is an Egyptian company, has set up the official North Korean telephone or cell phone system.
Ironic that an Egyptian company did that?
Yes, it was strange. I don't know if they were the high bidder or what, but they're the official one. So, and they're actually the use of cell phones are very expensive, but it's quite widespread. I think there are 250,000 cell phones officially inside of North Korea.
I was surprised to read that even South Korea has strict censorship laws that control what information can be disseminated about North Korea. Is that because the two Koreas are still officially at war with each other?
That's a big part of it, yes. The South Korea has a national security law, which is incredibly draconian. Punishable acts that can be interpreted as lending credibility or sympathy towards the North can be punished by anything up to execution, and they're not shy about using it.
And I would have thought South Korea, which seems to me to be a rather open society, wouldn't be doing this. I read a South Korean woman was imprisoned for possessing instrumental music with titles that praise the North.
Yeah, they're very serious about enforcing this. They still block all North Korean websites, all North Korean publications from the very extensive internet connections in Seoul. I mean, I think it's a little short-sighted, but they're still very much living in this Cold War world where they're trying to combat the influence of the North.
So do the media organizations you've written about here fear retribution from the South Korean as well as the North Korean governments if they transmit or post information that either of those governments deems inappropriate?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't think retribution is quite the right word, but there are certainly times in South Korean political history where the government has been more open to North Korea than others. This particular time happens to be one where the regime is hard-line against the North. But I could imagine certainly in a regime where in a government where they were much more open to the North, that they could easily make the world a more difficult place for these organizations.
You've said that these groups that we're talking about are having a transformative impact on the information the West receives about North Korea. Don't almost all of the stories about North Korea that appear in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post originate in or get confirmation from media outlets like Open Radio North Korea, the Daily NK, which is a website based in South Korea?
These organizations have become the sort of the go-to source for information about North Korea as you know, all mainstream news organizations have had to cut back on foreign bureaus and correspondents. They've become more and more dependent on organizations like this, NGOs, but also these kind of news organizations, and these have been particularly powerful.
Because in the past, we really had no clue in the years leading up to 2006 when North Korea detonated its first nuclear weapon. U.S. officials kind of believed that North Korea was on the brink of collapse.
Absolutely. I mean, the idea that that North Korea was on the brink of collapse was a very popular one through those years.
And then, wishful thinking?
Absolutely wishful thinking. But it's you know, I'm told this all the time in Seoul. I'm always told I joke about how many days or weeks people tell me till North Korea collapse, and I always say, let me tell you about this island off the coast of Florida that has been about to collapse for the last 50 years that we've been predicting.
Now, how about these organizations' objectivity? Aren't they advocates as well as reporters?
Absolutely. And this is a real serious concern. I mean, if you think of all journalism as operating on sort of a continuum from, you know, pure propaganda to pure fact, these organizations are a little closer to propaganda. Not that what they're saying is untrue necessarily, but they are reporting with a very clear political aim in mind, and I think it's important to read those reports with that in mind as a reader.
One of the most frequently cited by the Western media is the Daily NK, a website that's published in Korean, Chinese, English, and Japanese. Didn't the Daily NK embarrass the North Korean government in 2009 by intercepting a copy of Kim Jong-il's annual message before it appeared in North Korea's official newspaper?
Yes, this was one of the they've had many scoops, and this was perhaps not the most spectacular, but sort of showed the greatest sort of journalistic daring do and one they were most proud of. I gather that Rodong Shinbun, the official daily North Korean newspaper, was being moved around from one print setting place to the printer or something, and the sort of reporter in Pyongyang was able to intercept it and get it to the site the day before.
My guest is Robert Boynton. His article, North Korea's Digital Underground, is in the April issue of The Atlantic magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You visited Daily NK's offices in Seoul?
Yes, I spent some time there.
How sophisticated?
Well, you know, it's as sophisticated as any news organization in the sense that it's got lots of computers and a lot of defectors working there who really understand the subject matter. But the place doesn't look like different from any other sort of call center or newsroom that I've seen.
But more call center than a newsroom, you say?
Well, sort of. It's really dingy. There are a lot of cubicles. But I have to say, if you've been in any newspaper or magazine recently, that's what they look like.
Who's paying for them? Where do they get their money?
You know, they get their money from a combination of sources. The National Endowment for Democracy gives them some money. Other sort of independent news organizations like the Writers Without Borders and in Europe. There are a number of those kind of things, independent people. They get virtually no money from the South Korean government itself.
Who is Mr. Park? He the editor?
Park and Ho is one of the founders of the publication. Yes.
And he told you that he spends most of his time recruiting and training reporters on the North Korean border with China.
Right. He's the guy who really goes in and talks to people on the border. He worked there on the border for many years before the publication started. And he will talk to young defectors who have left, who want to do something to help further the cause of undermining North Korea, and introduce them to the idea of journalism. A lot of the people he has encountered there want to take violent acts against the government, against the regime, and he's trying to change that.
So it was only defectors? It's not people who just need to pick up a little extra cash?
Oh, I'm sure it's that too. The remarkable thing I find about North Korea is that for all of the awful things that go on there, some huge portion of the people who cross the border from North Korea to China come back. This is really a sort of migrant population. It's not, this is not like, you know, when Hungary and East Germany opened up and people were fleeing in one direction. These are people who are, you know, using that for their own resources.
In fact, you write about two of the Daily NK's reporters, a North Korean trader who travels freely in and out of the country, and a widow who passes on information she gets from her grown children. They could leave.
They could. Oh, they could certainly leave. I mean, the problem is once you've left North Korea and you're in China, where do you go then? So there actually are, you know, tens of thousands of North Koreans living on the border who simply don't have the ability to get out and get to South Korea or anywhere else.
Because it takes a lot of money and also help to get through all of China to go then to the south and be able to cross over to South Korea.
Right. They have to go through Mongolia or they have to go through other parts of China. And the you know, the South Korean government is not all that friendly towards most defectors who want to get to South Korea. When you present yourself at the consulate in one of the large towns in that part of China, you really won't be very well treated.
And I gather that a number of the people who have gotten into China, well, first of all, they're always in danger of being sent back, but women are often wind up in the sex trade or in the worst kinds of jobs.
Yeah, I mean they're ripe for exploitation. They're you know, very unfamiliar with the ways of the capital society. They can be fingered and sent back to North Korea to some awful camp or something like that. So they're the ultimate victims, which is really a tragic irony. They've left being victimized in their own country, and they get even more victimized in China.
What about Japan? Doesn't Japan have special interests, especially since they realized that some of their own citizens were being kidnapped? You spoke to Oshimaru Jiro, a journalist from Asia Press International who's based in Osaka, Japan. What's their involvement in this?
He's another one of these journalists who was spending a lot of time on the North Korean-Chinese border. He actually is friends with Park In-ho, and he was doing some journalism there and started realizing that there was a kind of story that that he couldn't tell that was being that was existing for them on the border, and some of the people who he was interviewing turned around and asked him whether he wanted them to actually become reporters
and film things and then smuggle things out.
Yeah, he has this very elaborate. He's a film person. He's basically a television person, and he developed these very elaborate protocols. Outfitted these people with hidden cameras, mostly hidden in bags and suitcases and things like that, and then trained them how to shoot and how to evade detection.
But isn't this border very closely guarded? We keep on reading about people who accidentally stray a couple of feet into North Korea and wind up in prison.
I mean, that's the great myth about this border. The border is I mean, there are guards on the border at intervals, but I mean, in many places, it's as badly patrolled as, say, the border between the United States and Canada.
So you got to be an idiot to get caught?
No, I don't think so. But, you know, this is not a border with barbed wire electrified fence or something like that. You can, if you are clever, know when and where to cross.
Also, isn't the fact that North Korea has gone through all these problems, the famine, hasn't that aided in this dissemination? You talk about the North Koreans setting up small open-air markets during the 1990s to buy and sell food after the government was unable to provide it. I guess that was because of the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yes. I mean, the combination of the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 80s and early 90s and then the terrible famine that occurred because of crop failures and also flooding made a lot of people who would never have gone over to China before decide to go over to try to get food because the government wasn't providing it.
They're illegal, but the government looks the other way?
They had to at that time because the population was starving. So some of these small unofficial markets were opening up. And with the food from China came information and technology.
And electronics.
And electronics, exactly.
So that's created another way to get information out. But where are we now? Are we going to have Kim Jong-un is likely to become the next leader? And unless something dramatic happens, like the terrible things that just happened in Japan, aren't we likely to see this just go on and on and on? And even if we get a bit more information out of North Korea, it will still remain one of the most dangerous countries in the world, if not the most dangerous?
I think that's a distinct possibility. I think that the information flow, the fact that people are actually willing to take the risks to listen to radio stations and are open to that kind of information is itself a sign that something is changing. But whether that change will lead to something as large as a, you know, the dissolution of the government is really unlikely.
Robert S. Boynton's article, North Korea's Digital Underground, is in the April issue of The Atlantic magazine. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.